If it seems intimidating, I just want to pause and encourage you. Mamas, logic is discovered. It's not created. And it gives a testimony to an intelligent mind apart from creation, which is why our culture is especially trying to attack it. Because if they can attack it or invalidate it, then they can try to silence a testimony to the existence of God.
Welcome to the Mama Bear Apologetics Podcast. I'm Hillary.
And I'm Amy.
We are just two gals who are spiritually armed, highly caffeinated,
and just sassy enough to make bad ideas cry.
Mama Bear is a ministry dedicated to helping you raise children who think critically, love biblically, and stand firm in the faith using scripture, reason, and reality.
Because remember, Mama Bears, this might not affect your faith,
but it might affect your children's. Hey, everyone. Welcome to another Mama Bear Apologetics podcast, a podcast dedicated to helping you raise children who think critically, love biblically, and stand firm in the faith using scripture, reason, and reality. Now, you are going to want to button down your thinking caps today because we are tackling a really important, completely relevant issue that's so practical, not only to your little ones, but to your older kids as well. We're going to be taking a look at reasonable faith, especially from the realm of logic. Now, we know that Christianity is based on good reasons, good evidence, and we can believe that Christianity is true. And that's where we need to come in and ask those good questions, because eventually someone's going to come up and ask, you know, why we believe what we believe and what evidence do we have that Christianity is in fact true. Now, belief and faith in Christianity is not something that is done blindly. In fact, it is based on good reasons, which if you remember from our last episode, we looked at several amazing, relevant, good reasons to believe that Christianity is true. So today we're going to shift our focus and instead talk about logic, because logic is the foundation for good reasoning. And when it comes to thinking through truth claims of any worldview, including Christianity, the way we reason through the evidences supporting its claims begins with logic. And trust me, parents, you want your kids to be able to think critically and think well, because when those truth claims come in, whether it's a friend in their classroom, or perhaps a Taylor Swift lyric, or whatever it may be, you want your kids to be able to spot good logic from bad logic. So before we get started, we always want to begin with good definitions. So Tricia, you're joining me here today. Absolutely love having you present. So what is it that we mean when we refer to logic?
Well, I don't know about you, but whenever I hear the word logic, I sort of freeze up and I get this choking feeling in my throat because it just seems so abstract. But really, it just means how we order our thoughts. We study right reason and how we draw valid conclusions. So if we say this and this, then this. So the question becomes, is the then this a valid conclusion? Do the premises set it up properly? And is that a valid conclusion that follows from those premises? And that's just what logic is. And we use it really every single day, all day. We just don't even think about it because it's so foundational and fundamental. We're not thinking about the reasons for it. We just use these foundational laws of logic, they're called, because they're part of everyday thought. So for instance, you go to the grocery store and you're comparing prices of milk. Well, you're using logic when you're making those categories. Sometimes you have to make certain categories match up, like ounces, you know, to quarts, and you have to fix the categories. All of that requires logical reasoning. And in that, we use the foundational laws of logic to reason through our premises.
Yeah. And, you know, it's so different from what we see going on today. Like going on today, it's not really that thinking is based in logic. Instead, it's based on emotional appeal that we see a lot, especially with our kids, our teens, and even, you know, millennial generation. The focus was never on right ordered thinking. It was, okay, we're going to go along with whatever sort of stimulates us, gets us motivated, passionate, or breaks our heart. And that can actually be a tool of manipulation to where we never want to discount feelings, but instead we want to say, okay, but is what they're saying true? And that's where these sort of things like first principles come into play. Yeah. So, you know, when we think of logic and this concept called first principles, you know, why are they called that?
Yes, because they're so fundamental. Yeah. So they're first. In other words, they're foundational to how we think. You could call them foundational laws of logic or foundational laws of thought and communication. either of those would be fine because both of those statements about them are true. We can't really even think without them, much less communicate. They're inherent in reality. For example, if somebody hands me a banana and says, here's your apple, I automatically think, no, this is a banana. Mm-hmm. Because a thing is always itself, not something yeah. else. And that's the foundational law of logic called the law of identity. Yeah. And nobody sets out to prove that that's true. We know it's true, and to deny it's true is to prove it, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah. notice I said that it's how we think automatically. Yeah. So we don't, when we're using these foundational laws of logic, we don't have to go through mental steps to decide whether something is itself. These laws are self-evident. Their ground is objective truth about mm-hmm. the reality that exists outside of our mind that really is out there. So we don't really have to prove them. That's what we mean by self-evident.
Yeah. You know, and I love how, because, you know, we talked earlier about how it's foundational and how they truly do build on one another. It's self-evident within reality, and it's objective because we now can correlate it to reality to where it makes thinking easier, to where we can see it. It makes sense. And, you know, it brings to mind a video, I'm sure you probably saw it, Tricia, of there was a gentleman on a college campus, and he was, you know, asking people, okay, you know, male and female, you know, are they objective reality? And well, no, somebody can feel this way or that way. And this gentleman who was probably, you know, 5'8", he was like, okay, so how is it that I don't believe the example he used was like, I believe that I am a 6'8" elderly Asian man. And the gal was just kind of like staring at him. She's like, well, if you believe so, like it takes so much more effort to affirm a falsehood because it's not based on reality. And yet we see that's what's waging in our culture today is they're trying to deny the existence of objective truth, deny the existence of the authority of reality and the correspondence between them. That it's, this is why parents, you know, it's so important to know this and to be aware of it because our culture is actively waging war against these.
You'll see this kind of video. Sorry to interrupt you, but
no, you're great.
This kind of video. And the person, when you say I'm a 6 foot Asian person, they'll mm-hmm. just look at you like you've lost your mind.
Yeah.
Well, why would you think that? That's not what you are. Mm. And they have no ability to see how that applies to perception of gender
yeah,
and
absolutely.
The biological reality. They don't even make that connection. That's how far removed we have been
yeah.
in our culture and how deeply this mantra of truth is what you make it. Truth is mm-hmm. subjective. It's relative to the person.
Yeah.
And even saying Hinduism or Buddhism don't hold to the foundational laws of logic. They're ultimate and beyond the logic. Mm. Even that's a truth claim.
Yeah.
Which is claiming it's true for everyone. They don't even realize how self-defeating that is that to make that claim. So
yeah.
it's an interesting phenomenon to see people so disconnected mm-hmm. from reality right now and to argue yeah. so vehemently for their view.
I know. I mean, they're truly at war with the authority that comes from the existence of that objective reality. I mean, yes. that's where this battle is coming from. And I mean, one of the things that we see, you know, skeptics, you know, always throwing at Christianity is saying that, you know, Christianity is make-believe. It's fantasy. It's like Santa Claus, the tooth fairy, or the spaghetti monster in the sky. But that, unfortunately, that's the opposite of being supported by logical reasoning.
Yes. And that's a really exciting thing to see because we can agree with them that this spaghetti monster in the sky or this feel-good Santa in the sky doesn't exist. And we have for so long in evangelical Christianity appealed to the emotions.
Yeah.
Somewhere along the way, we lost our foundation mm-hmm. that our founding fathers gave us, who were Christians, many of them,
yep.
who debated and discussed what truth is and the philosophical concerns that passed away for us. But we need to return to the grounding of what truth is because yeah. Christianity, like all worldviews, makes truth claims about everyday experience of reality as well as about ultimate reality, as does every other worldview, as I said. So logic is required to evaluate those claims and conclude whether they're true or false. And whether the postmodern wants to admit it or not, they use these and think according to them and communicate with them automatically. So Christianity, and we as Christians should welcome the questions regarding the reasons that we think that Christianity is true. Now, this means we're going to need to study our faith and the reasons we say it is true. But once we know the laws of logic, that's just great information. And all it does is confirm what we've known all along, that these are reality and we can't deny them without proving them because they're self-evident. But it does lay a foundation for us in the future, showing how our faith in Christ is warranted, how it makes the most sense of reality.
Yeah. No, and I love that because you're absolutely right. For the longest time, several generations, it was very much an emotional appeal with regards to Christianity. I mean, even some of those, you know, old-fashioned white tent revivals, it was very much an emotional appeal, usually leveraging the horrors of damnation, you know, to try and get people in an altar call situation. And then it's like, oh, great, you're a Christian. And then, like, you know, sort of chucked you into the world without any sort of robust training. And that's where, you know, we love Christianity because it is testable. It's noble. We're invited to ask questions, to research and to study and to prove the claims, especially that the original gospel writers were making. I mean, they gave evidence. And that's what's so beautiful is because now what we're seeing a shift within culture happening over the last 4 years, especially to where this generation, Gen Z, Gen Alpha, and even the millennials are very disenchanted with the postmodern worldview because it cannot ground reality, the trajectory for their life, and the purpose for one's life. And so what we're seeing, and it's higher in men than it is in women, but we are seeing an increase in both of church attendance between young men and young women. And it's like, church, we've got a moment in culture where we can capitalize on the revival that's happening from people looking for an objective anchor for who they are, purpose for their life, morality, goodness, beauty, all of these things. And we need to start with logic. And so, you know, Tricia, you mentioned how, you know, we use logic in everyday life and, you know, very straightforward, like, you know, an apple is an apple. It either is or isn't. So what are some other laws of logic that sort of reveal the realities that we see within the world?
Well, most foundationally, there are three basic laws of logic or laws of thought and communication or first principles. And we've already talked about them, but let's just give them a label so that people know when they're talking about logic or they hear someone who is taking a logic course, they know what it is. And they'll go, oh, I already know that. But now let's give it a name. So the law of identity just says a thing is what it is. It's always itself.
Yeah.
If that weren't true, we couldn't make any claim about reality at all. So a banana is a banana.
Yeah.
And it has a nature that distinguishes it from other things. But the case is, if it's a banana, it is a banana. That enables us to think. Without that law of identity, we wouldn't even be able to have a thought process. The second law is the law of excluded middle. A statement is either true or not true. And there's no middle option. Now, when I say a statement here, I'm talking about a proposition kind of statement that declares something about reality. Not all statements are true propositions that can be evaluated as true or false, like pass me the milk, a command, or do you have the scissors? Those aren't the statements that I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is statements that make a claim about reality, which are technically called propositions.
Yeah.
And whenever you make these statements, a thing must be what it is, it must be itself, and it must be either or. It can't be a middle option. For instance, it's either an apple or not an apple. And then the third one is the law of non-contradiction, which says two opposite statements cannot be both true at the same time and in the same sense. And the statement, for instance, it cannot be both a banana and not a banana simultaneously. Now, notice when I'm stating this law of non-contradiction, to be precise, we must state true opposites. So we state the affirmative, and then the opposite would be the negation of that. So God exists and God does not exist. That's negation. So we need to clarify that. Otherwise, it gets confusing. So if I say this is a dog, the opposite is this is not a dog. Okay. Or if I say it's raining, the opposite would be it is not raining, the negation of the affirmation. And this is important just as you're talking to people that we be pretty precise in what we mean by opposite, because there can be some confusion that can be created in conversation if we don't make sure that we understand what we mean by these and how fundamental they are. We're saying A is not A, you know. So that's very simple. And it seems sort of duh when you think about it, because we do it all the time automatically. Yeah. We can't avoid these. It's not something we created or generated. I understand these laws of logic to flow from the intellect of the ultimate being.
Yeah.
And so that's why our whole world, that we see a sense of order and the disorder, mm-hmm. we notice and it bothers us, or we recognize it as a disorderedness. Like when used to play pickup sticks and drop them, they never fall in a perfect pattern, really, of any sort. They fall, generally speaking, randomly from order. Even if I had them, I don't know if you ever used to, but hold them with certain colors in certain parts of my hand, like the yellow up here and the blue down here, when I drop them, they move toward disorder. And so this kind of awareness about reality, that these are the characteristics, help us to lay a foundation for all the other evidences for the truth of Christianity. This is where we begin, even when we don't realize it.
Hey, this is Hillary from Mama Bear Apologetics, and I want to tell you a little bit about the Air Doctor. So, two stories about this. Number one, my parents came to visit after we had a bunch of construction downstairs, and I noticed that my dad kept coughing and sneezing down in the basement. So, what we did was we put our Air Doctor down there, and I tell you, like, one night, and he was not coughing anymore. Second story about Air Doctor. Everybody marvels at the fact that we have a cat and we have a cat box and nobody can smell it. So there are a lot of benefits to the Air Doctor. You're going to have fewer odors. You're going to have reduced allergy symptoms, better sleep, extra protection during wildfire season. I know we got some of our California mama bears. This is a big one. And just peace of mind and cleaner air for your kids. I mean, what's more important than having clean air? So Air Doctor has a powerful 3-stage filtration, which captures extremely small particles, about 100 times smaller than what typical air purifiers can remove. And not only that, but it captures airborne contaminants that you don't want breathing in, like dust and pollen, mold spores, pet dander, bacteria, viruses, odors, smoke, ozone, all the things. And it's really, really quiet. Even though we hear it turn on, it's still very quiet. It's like you just barely hear the fan that's coming on. It's got an auto feature mode, which means that you don't have to be fiddling with it all the time. It ensures optimal air 24/7. And it also even gives you change filter reminders, so you don't have to put some kind of alarm in your phone for every however long that you need to change the air filter. Air Doctor has won Newsweek's Reader's Choice Award for Best Air Purifier, and it was voted Best Air Purifier in the Green Matters Approved Awards. So if you're wanting cleaner air, or you just have a cat and you don't want it to smell like you have a cat, head on over to airdoctorpro.com and use promo code MBA to get up to $300 off today. Air Doctor comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, plus a 3-year warranty. That's an $84 value. So get this exclusive podcast-only offer now at airdoctorpro.com. That's AIRDOCTORPRO.com. And use the promo code MBA, as in Mama Bear Apologetics.
We are so thankful for the sponsors of Mama Bear Apologetics, who see the value in what we do and want to connect with our audience. Today's episode is sponsored by the Every Woman's Bible. The Every Woman's Bible is a study Bible created for both the heart and the mind, because loving God well means engaging truth deeply. It's designed for women who want to grow in their understanding of Scripture while also discovering how God's Word speaks into their everyday lives and God-given purposes. This Bible is packed with thoughtful study notes and devotionals written by more than 100 women scholars and contributors from around the world. It helps bring cultural, historical, and literary context to the text so you can better understand what Scripture meant then and how it applies now. With helpful charts, maps, illustrations, and articles that tackle some of the harder passages of the Bible, the Every Woman's Bible equips you to read with clarity and confidence. It's available in the New Living Translation, and the King James Version is coming soon. You can also deepen your prayer life with the Every Woman's Prayer Journal, filled with scripture-based prayers to help you pray boldly and intentionally. Learn more at everywomansbible.com and discover God's heart for you through deeper study and reflection.
What's great is your kids pick it up very quickly. Like, I remember having these discussions with my little ones, and we were watching the live action Cinderella. It was the one, I forget the name of the actress, but she had like this gorgeous sort of, you know, blue and pink dress, and it was absolutely pretty. But at the beginning of the movie, it's Ella and her mom's talking about, you know, fairies and all these different things. And Ella asks her, "Oh, mother, do you really believe in fairies?" And she goes, "Ella, I believe in everything." And even just that statement there, my middle son, he goes like, "Wait a second, you can't believe in everything. That means you believe in contradictions." And he like went off on this whole tangent. And I'm like, oh, that's awesome. Because
it's it sunk in.
Like, yay, mommy win. But it's great because now he's able to spot it. And, you know, sometimes I think we sell modern children short, because they're so clever. And when you look, I notice this when I look at especially like Victorian children's literature. I mean, these are very robust stories that today would be marketed more toward adults because of the content. But yet we kind of underestimate the intellectual capabilities of our kiddos to where, man, when you start talking about this stuff, it registers, they start picking it up. And I mean, I know my classical conversation mamas are like, you know, preach. kids recognize this. So if it seems intimidating, I just want to pause and encourage you, mamas, this is foundational for knowing God, because logic is discovered, it's not created, and it gives a testimony to an intelligent mind apart from creation, which is why our culture is especially trying to attack it. Because if they can attack it or invalidate it, then they can try to silence a testimony to the existence of God. So that's why it's under assault. It points back to the truth of God's creation, objective reality, and it's important in the discipleship of our children. Now, Tricia, you know, and we've talked about this just a little bit, but let's dive in just a bit deeper. You know, these laws of logic, they help us know truth. Like, and how is it that they do that?
Well, we said that not all statements or comments or questions are truth claims, mm-hmm. propositions.
Yeah.
But when someone does make a truth claim about something, that's a black dog. Logic can tell us whether that thing is that thing or something else. Logic can tell us whether that truth claim can be, logic can tell us that that truth claim can't be both true and false at the same time. Mm-hmm. And in the same sense, it can't be a black dog and not a black dog at the mm-hmm. same time and in the same sense. Now, I think that we need to clarify what we mean by in the same sense.
Yeah.
So let's say the Christian says God exists.
Yeah.
And we say that maybe to our pantheist or Hindu friend, and she agrees, God exists. So we leave that conversation thinking, yeah, we agree on God.
But,
and we don't, right?
Yeah.
And the reason that we don't is because while we agree that God exists, as mm-hmm. we've talked about before, we each define the term God differently. For mm-hmm. the theist, God is the personal creator. And for the pantheist, God is just the universe itself. Right. So the pantheist and the theist don't think of God and what God is in the same sense. Now, does that ring a bell? So in the same sense, because we must define our terms, as we repeatedly say here at Mama Bear, once we define our terms, and we can only define our terms if we say, what do you mean by God? Mm-hmm. And then I'll share with you what I mean by God. Mm. So that's the only way we can truly worship the same God. That's the only way we can understand what's the difference is between true and false, opposites, to say that God exists and God does not exist. We must begin there so that we can actually make propositions about this referent that we're talking about and get anywhere in a conversation, even if it's just to say they're not the same. Yeah. And that's a huge step with Hindus, that these beliefs are not the same because we do not understand God in the same sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's one thing that's fascinating, especially as you study worldviews, is just that question alone, does God exist? Every worldview has a completely different perspective on whether or not God exists and in what form and to what extent. And so, you know, that even just debunks the kind of the Oprah Winfrey push of, oh, there's many pathways to God. You just find whatever works, you know, this whole relativistic mindset, it completely explodes. Because if we can't even agree on the simple question of whether or not God exists, then of course, not all pathways can be right. Not all pathways are true. And from there, we can now start unpacking, okay, well, why is it that you believe what you believe? Can we actually see this within reality? Is it true? And we can have an amazing evangelistic encounter with someone maybe in our family life or in our office or wherever we're at, and be able to point them back to truth. But it always comes back to this question of truth. And what's amazing is Tricia, you know, these laws of logic, they help us know God, because it's often said that, you know, to have faith, it's all just faith alone. And we unpack that a little bit in our first podcast, but let's go a little bit deeper that, you know, knowing God doesn't just require faith alone. There's more to it.
And the Bible tells us this in Romans chapter 1, yes, that there are certain things that we can know without faith, solely based on reason. And these bits of information are given to us by common grace that everyone receives. And these revelations by God, what we call general revelation, end up rendering us without excuse before a holy God, because we come to know that God exists. We can look at the evidence for his existence, and we fail to worship him as that God. Mm-hmm. So how do laws of logic help us know him? Well, we make rational truth claims about him that can be evaluated as true or false based on the evidence. So once we define, for instance, what we mean by God, that God, whatever that God is himself. Let's say I'm describing the personal creator God. And then once I describe the personal creator God, which is what Romans 1 describes, we can describe his nature, some of his divine characteristics, which would tell us how he would act and how he would not act. Mm. So the law of identity is revealed in that. We can also say he's either God or not God. He's either the personal creator kind of God, or he's not the personal creator kind of God. There's no middle option.
Yeah.
Okay. And then thirdly, we can know that this God that we're talking about can't both exist and not exist at the same time. This gives us a starting point for providing evidence or reasons for thinking this kind of God exists and this kind of God that you're talking about, that is the universe, for instance, does not exist, because both of those cannot be true at the same time, simply because they're contradictory. So it's good to be able to recognize that these laws of logic are operating, because then we can have a sensible conversation. Otherwise, you walk away thinking you've agreed when you haven't. And this happens frequently in conversations with people, for instance, from the Latter-day Saints or Jehovah's Witnesses, where they're using the same terms but mean them differently, which we've talked about is equivocation. Mm-hmm. But it's an issue that is grounded in these foundational laws of logic. And we have to start there to even recognize when someone is not even making a rational claim or making a rational proposition that needs to be itself dug into by asking, what do you mean by that word you just used?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's so much in culture that you can use to help your kids think well. I'm thinking back in November when we were watching some of the presidential debates, and there was a statement made at the time by President Biden that, you know, he was just going on and on about how, oh man, I am for the children. I'm for the children. And I'm also for abortion. And my son paused and goes, wait a second. Those two cannot coexist. So it's, again, an amazing testimony to how, man, when we have these conversations with our kids and we train them to think well, to recognize inconsistencies, faulty logic, especially asking definitions of terms, we can help them stand firm against secular culture just by engaging their mind. Now, Tricia, you had mentioned contradictions, and that, you know, that's an important discussion to have. And one of the big questions that is asked very often among Christianity is this idea that perhaps the Trinity, the concept of the Trinity, three in one, is contradictory in and of itself. Now, I'm curious of your thoughts with regard to that statement.
Yes. And let me back up and say one thing about what you said, Amy. that the purpose of us doing this is not to win the argument. We say the time, but I feel like I need to reiterate that.
Yeah.
It's not to teach our kids to argue well. They need to be able to argue well in terms of being able to follow premises to a conclusion and recognize whether that conclusion follows from those premises or not. Yes. But not so they be argumentative.
Right.
In public discourse with their friends or with a professor in college. That's not the purpose. The purpose is to understand that every worldview makes truth claims about reality and you can evaluate those. And even those that deny that truth exists show that it exists by their very statements of denial. Mm-hmm. So these are unavoidable and foundational. And once we grasp these, we can understand so much about the world that the Lord gave us and about Him Himself. Now, to say something is contradictory is to say it's not logical, right?
Yeah.
So we as Christians have shut down and shut up on this issue of the Trinity because we're terrified someone's going to ask us about it. We can't delve into this all here. We could do a separate session on the Trinity if you would like later. But the Trinity itself is not contradictory. However, we do believe the Trinity is what God is, that God exists in Trinity or triunity. Because it does exceed reason, our ability to grasp it through reasoning, if this, then this, then if this and this, then this. So faith is trusting in the authority of someone about something we can't see. And we trust that person because that person has proved himself trustworthy. So in this case, we believe that Trinity explains to us who God is because Christ says it. He speaks of the Spirit as God. He speaks of Himself and claims to be God through forgiveness of sin, through accepting worship. And He gives us access to these truths that exceed our ability to reason and know through reason. So the Trinity does exceed our ability to reason it out. It is revealed to us by the person of Christ within the New Testament. So that leads us to need to be able to explain why we think the New Testament is true. But that's different to say that a doctrine exceeds our reason and is a mystery is different than to say that it is illogical or contradictory. So let's make sure what would be contradictory if we said it about God. To say God is one person in three natures or three persons in three natures.
Right.
That would be contradictory, or one person in three persons. Maybe I should have said it that way, or one nature in three natures. That would be contradictory, illogical. To say God is one person in three persons would be contradictory. But to say God is three persons in one nature means that in one sense, He is three persons, and in another sense, He is one nature. And in the claim of the Trinity, that is not illogical. Why we have such trouble with it is because we have one person per being, you know, the nature of the human being, and we exist finitely within a body. So it's impossible for us to be three persons in one nature. But remember, we're not making this claim about a finite embodied person. We're making this claim about that God is three persons in one nature, about a purely spiritual being who is infinite. So this is alien to our experience, and this is why we can say it exceeds our reason, but it is not unreasonable because it's a mystery because it transcends our human experiences because we're only one person per being as finite persons, and we're confined to a body. But it is not illogical to think that a spiritual being who is infinite, completely immaterial, could have three centers of consciousness while still being one person.
Yeah.
So we can know this and know that even though it transcends what we know through our senses and experience, that it can be possible for an infinite being. So we know that it is so by faith in the authority of Christ, who said God is Trinity. And that's what we mean by truths that we know by faith exceed or transcend our reason, but they're not contradictory to reason, and they're not illogical. So we can't know this, for instance, about God, that He is triune, unless he chooses to disclose this about himself. We can't know that God is Trinity by looking at the trees, the sky, the stars. We can know that God exists, but we can't know that he is triune unless he chooses to disclose that. That is a very intimate truth about God. It's a beautiful thing, and we can know this amazing truth about him, even though we can't know what it is like to be three persons in one nature due to our finiteness.
We have a podcast as well that dives into the Trinity just a little bit. If you want to check that out, it'll be in our show notes. Or if you go on mamabearapologetics.com, head over to our podcast. You'll be able to find it there. Now, Trisha, of course, you know, with kids and you've got grandbabies and everything, they always come up with great questions. And one thing, whether it's little kids, big kids, or even adults, they try to do this sort of logical karate chop with regards to the nature of God. And it often goes a little bit like this, you know, if God is infinite, if he's omnipotent, he's all powerful, all these things, then, you know, is he sort of bound by logic? Or is he able to do illogical things? And the example that's always given is, you know, can he create a rock so big that he can't lift it? And it's kind of meant to invalidate God's nature, invalidate his power, his authority, that sort of thing. But yeah, it actually, the argument in and of itself completely falls short just within the question. So you want to unpack that a little bit for us?
I will. And then I bet you'll have some comments that you can add to it. And that is, this is directly related, as you spoke of, to God's omnipotence, his infinity, lack of limits of any sort. God can do all possible things logically, and all things in accordance with his nature. And this means that there are some things God cannot do that are not lacks of a perfection.
Yeah.
Because a lack is something that doesn't fulfill a perfection. So God cannot lie. That is not a weakness in his omnipotence. That is actually a perfection. God cannot sin or do evil. And James says that he cannot tempt someone to sin. Why? Because it is alien to his nature. So these abilities to sin or do evil are actually a lack of a perfection, and God possesses no lacks in his perfection. He is fully perfect in every possible way that a being could be perfect. So he cannot make a four-sided triangle, because by definition, triangles are three-sided. And to do so would actually contradict his nature. It would contradict his intellect. It would contradict the order and design and the logic that flows from God's intellect. So this is a description of who he is: ordered, design, coherence, reasonable, logical. All of these flow from God's nature as the ultimate intellect.
Yeah, no, and that's such a good point, because sometimes, especially with kids, they think that true power comes in the ability to do anything and everything. But really, if God could lie, if he could make these contradictions, he would almost be more like one of those capricious Greek gods than he would be the divine authority and creator of the universe. So with a lot of kids, one thing you have to kind of point out to them is the ability to do all things doesn't necessarily constitute actual power, because to lie, to manipulate, to break these laws, that actually isn't a good thing. That isn't an attribute. That, like you said, is a lacking in a person's character. So important to point those things out.
Now, I would also just to drive home this point, we can simply ask our kids, which would be more perfect to say about God, that he told lies or that he didn't lie? And I guess there isn't a more perfect, but which kind of God would be the perfect God?
Yeah.
Can lie, can't lie. The can't lie is going to be the God with the perfection. And he has something that a perfection that the God who does lie doesn't have. And your example of the Greek gods or Roman gods are perfect, because we see they're arbitrary and they're very much like humans.
Yeah.
Just on, you know, steroids.
Yeah. Grander scales. They occasionally throw a lightning bolt, you know.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. No, I love that. Great, great example there. So, one possible pushback that people could give is, doesn't using logic to know God mean that we're kind of like putting logic over God? You know, and some people can kind of get hung up on the order of that. So, you know, is it God first before logic? Like how would we sort of address that perhaps challenge?
This will be important in many discussions about God. There, remember we talked about that we categorize things. Yeah. Whenever we think about them, we categorize things according to their nature. Mm-hmm. We understand that ounces is different than pounds. Volume is different than mass, those sorts of things. So the laws of logic help us, or enable us rather, to set up these mental categories of things as distinct and to group them, and to know they're not something else, that ounces is not pounds, okay? So in philosophy, there is an order or category called being. That's called metaphysics, and an order or category called knowing, which is called epistemology.
Yep.
So what we have to do is make sure that when we're talking about logic and its relationship to God, that we distinguish between these two categories, these two orders. One is the order of being, and in the order of being, God, of course, is first. Mm-hmm. Without God, there is no logic, there is nothing, okay? Mm-hmm. But in the order of knowing, that is, how we know about God, then logic comes first because we reason in order to know that God exists. Now, not all apologists agree on this, and there is a different view called presuppositionalism. Mm-hmm. But I don't hold to that view because I think it confuses these two categories, the order mm-hmm. of knowing and the order of being. God is always first, premier in the order of being. But in the order of how we as humans know about God, Romans 1 says we look at the effects that he has imprinted on the world, and therefore we know he exists. Mm. So that is reasoning from the effects back to the cause. Yeah. So in the way that we know God, we know him and know that he is, and some of his divine attributes by reasoning using logic and the reasoning process called a discursive reasoning process. Mm-hmm. If this and this, then this. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely how we know him. So that is basically the way we get to that conclusion.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's a bit of a categorical error, confusing the two things as one. So, yes. All right. So as you know, we're wrapping this up. This has just been a wonderful discussion and this look of logic. But, you know, I know some people are probably out there sort of wondering, you know, as we're looking at all of these mental categories and, you know, distinguishing between two different things, you know, is there more to how we gain knowledge about truth and God?
These foundational laws of logic are the starting point. Yep. And they can feel a little bit confusing, but if you just know that there's a law of identity, there's a law of excluded middle, there's a law of non-contradiction, and I love the non-contradiction one because opposites can't both be true, mm. or something can't be both true and false at the same time in the same right. sense. Just knowing that one and understanding it helps us to recognize statements that don't make any sense that we call self-defeating. Right. But stepping forward from this, we're going to talk about next time we're together, what truth actually is. Yeah. In the following episode, we're going to talk about applied logic, how we reason in the world using deduction and induction. So that will give us a broader foundation for how we use logic to come to certain conclusions. And we'll touch on those and flesh that out a little bit more. But one step at a time, we're doing great. And we're going to get to some more big questions. And we'll have all this firm grounding underneath us when we do. So we're Christians because we believe Christianity is true. And we use our reasoning to come to this conclusion, beginning with the laws of logic I just discussed that are self-evident, that we don't even think about, that tell us the difference between true and false.
Yeah.
And then we argue that it is true, that truth exists, God exists, the New Testament's reliable, these sorts of evidences for the truth of Christianity. But we have to start here. And by the way, Dr. Norman Geisler, one of the greatest thinkers of the 20th and into the 21st century, mm-hmm. Who I sat under his teaching, I'm totally Geislerized in the way I think about the world and reasoning. And he's the reason I'm a Christian apologist. He came to this framework called the 12 points that show Christianity is true.
Yeah.
Now, in what we call classical apologetics forever, as long as back into the medieval times. The Christians have reasoned through the truth of Christianity by starting with the existence of God and the evidence for the existence of God. Mm-hmm. But what he realized is that now truth was being brought into question. Mm-hmm. And if truth didn't even exist, then how can we say that we're offering a true argument about the existence of God? So he backed up and added to his points about the truth of Christianity, this notion that truth exists. He did the hard legwork for us, and some other of his colleagues did the hard work for us, bringing, for instance, Aristotle's and Aquinas' thought about the issue of the existence of truth into our century so that we can use it to ground and settle and moor this untethered philosophy of postmodernism, which says that there is no truth and you just, whatever you feel is what is reality. So this is important for us to begin here. We've not wasted our times, and it does relate specifically to the culture that we live in, who thinks that there is no grounding for anything that we say, and it's to each his own. That leaves us floating on a sea of personal opinion and confusion. And as Christians, we're not there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. So let's put it into the practical for the mamas, the grandmamas, the dads out there. Like, how do we start pouring this into our kids? So I'll let you hit with some examples and I'll chip in as well. But let's talk about like younger kids, because it can seem a little intimidating to be like, okay, I'm going to bring my six-year-old over and we're going to talk about the law of non-contradiction. But there is some very kid-friendly, appropriate ways to do this. So,
and we don't... We may not use that word, right?
Exactly.
Now, some kids are ready for it. Mm-hmm. And the only reason sometimes I introduce the language is so that we aren't intimidated when we hear that language. We may not care a bit about talking about the law of non-contradiction, but we hear somebody that's taking philosophy 101 talk about it, or the correspondence theory of truth, and suddenly we're intimidated and we don't realize we already know this. We've learned this. We just didn't call it that because we didn't know it was that name. So I want our mama bears and our nana bears to know that these are the terms that people are using. But with your six-year-old, we can just do simple games like putting a toy in the bag and asking the child if the toy is in the bag or not in the bag, and then saying, maybe it's in the bag and not in the bag at the same time.
Yeah.
And most six-year-olds will go, no, you know, so they even understand this. What are your thoughts about some ideas with younger children?
Yeah, no. Oh, well, and those examples are super practical. It's like, okay, are we in the room or are we outside of the room? You know, all of these things of playing the games is really easy with the little ones of doing, because then they recognize. What helps too, I found with mine, is like I usually have a teacup handy. And this, you know, law of non-contradiction, it's, okay, this cup cannot be both, you know, boiling hot and frigid cold at the same time. Okay, let's you know, put our hand up here and feel, is this warm? Is it cold? Oh, it's hot. Oh, it's actually cold. And so it's great to where they can actually see the cause and effect, feel it real time, and know, oh yeah, you're right. They cannot be both, you know, boiling hot and freezing cold at the same time. So examples are really great with kids. Things that they can touch as well. You mentioned here, about manipulatives, to where, you know, if you're at the grocery store, so many parents, you know, it's common just to put on a show for your kid on your phone. Instead, you know, point things out. Okay, you know, let's look at apples and tomatoes. It's, oh, they're similar. They kind of have a similar shape, maybe even a similar color. But does that mean they're the same thing? No, they're not. What makes an apple? What makes a tomato a tomato? And that helps your kids put those objective anchors that even when things look similar, they can be described in a similar way, but that doesn't mean that they are identity-wise are the exact same thing. There's a difference between that which describes us and that which defines us. And that is especially important for our kids to understand the difference between those two things.
Yeah, that's great. I was just thinking of like drawing a circle and a square when you're talking about
perfect. Yeah.
Or using the plastic, you know, even younger than that, the square, the little game where they have to put the square in the square hole.
Oh, yeah, right.
The circle, little... in the circle hole.
Yeah.
And just to be able to say to your 2 to 3 year old, the square won't fit in the circle. Mm-hmm. It's not circle. It's not round. And showing them the distinctions between things, we do it automatically.
Yeah.
Mama bears, you're teaching your kids the law of identity, the law of non-contradiction, the law of excluded middle, automatically, you're already doing this. Now just tether it to the Christian worldview and where we're headed with this in order to explain why Christianity is true. So it serves an eternal purpose to teach these. They're not just for your child's personal learning, but for them to know God and understand the world that he created. And then for older kids, I hear you talking a lot about sitting down and watching movies with them, where we don't just say, just put a cocoon and lots of cotton balls around them and wrap them in bubble wrap. We begin to sit down and take apart and look at and analyze and see their reactions to certain things when we think they're ready, because we're the parents and we know best for our children and for their personalities. So we explain to them the importance of defining terms. Yeah. And when we begin to ask our even 8 to 10 and then beyond kids, what do you mean by that? Yeah. And they're forced to define terms. They begin to realize where some of the problem in communication is. So you can use the burger in the bag to explain the law of non-contradiction, or the cup being hot and cold. Even explaining that to a teenager or a college student may sound ridiculous, but as confused as they are right now about the nature of truth and whether truth exists, using these simple examples and returning to them for our young adult kids is not always a fruitless thing, because it tells them that their view must be tethered to reality for them to, for it to make any sense and for it to be livable for them. So no matter what claims they make in philosophy, can they live consistently with that claim?
Yeah.
So explain how God, and then apply it to God. God either exists, this God that I'm describing, or he does not exist. Well, maybe God is just the rock. That's why it's important to define your terms.
Yeah.
There, you define what you mean. Do you mean by God everything in the universe, or do you mean God, the personal creator? It's important to define your terms. And when it comes to gender, a person either is biologically male or female. There's no third sex.
Nope.
Even the Society of the North American Society of Intersex study, and that's not quite the correct name, but you know what I'm talking about. They recognize there is no third sex. There may be aberrations through hormonal influences or through genetic influences of those two sexes, but there is no third sex. So whenever we begin to see how this applies in our culture, we begin to understand why these laws of logic, these foundations of the way we think, are so important for our students, our teenagers, and even our young adults. So what we want them to understand from this, that when we talk about the gender binary, and Hillary has spoken of the gender binary being a reality, while our tendencies and our expression of our sexuality is on a spectrum, because some kids, girls like to do climb trees and others, but do it like a girl. Some guys like to dance great as a guy. So this is why it's the goal for gender confusion, to bring the mind into alignment with reality rather than to mutilate the body to match the misperception of reality. And that's where we can go with these laws of logic with our older kids and young adults.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's integral to dismantle the sacred cow of feelings. And I don't mean this to disregard feelings, but I've said for years, feelings are real, but they're not always true. And so with our kids, they have been groomed by culture to react emotionally rather than think critically. And what logic does is logic comes in, and whenever a claim is made, it separates the truth claim from perhaps the emotional reaction. We say, okay, we can sympathize with perhaps someone's emotional reaction. We understand perhaps their feelings are real, unsolicited. But that doesn't mean that it's true, because feelings will either align and affirm reality, or they will be in rejection to it. Feelings cannot create reality. And so when we merge logic with the emotion, then we can rightly evaluate the claims within culture and raise up children who are less susceptible of being manipulated by an emotional appeal. Instead, we need to raise well-rounded children who rightly our hearts can break for another individual, but we do not allow feelings to now supersede truth. Instead, we hold feelings accountable to truth. And that is so important for especially our teen generation.
One thought I had when you were talking about that is that this, the next step would be, this shows us how to love well.
Exactly.
And that the worst possible thing you could do with someone suffering from what we would call in psychology a delusion,
right,
is to affirm the delusion that is destructive.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a most unloving thing. To think that the building is not burning and to run into it, to affirm their perception that the building is burning, it's not burning, it would be a terrible thing to do to someone. And if we understand that our act of love must be to say, this must be an awful emotion to have, to feel like this all the time. My prayer is that your thinking will become more clear. And if you would like to talk about what that looks like, then we can talk about it so that they can learn to walk. While the emotions don't usually change right away, although sometimes they may, we can learn to walk with those unwieldy emotions in a biblically satisfying, fulfilling, and God-honoring way. And then ultimately, it will be to our good.
Absolutely. Well, mamas, papas, grandmas, anyone who's listening, we are so grateful for you to join us today. We hope this podcast has been a blessing to you. If you would like more information with regards to our ministry, head over to mamabearapologetics.com. That's mamabearapologetics.com. We've got podcasts, we've got blogs, we've got resources. You can request a speaker. We've got all the things to help you grow in knowledge and wisdom of the Lord. So, Tricia, thank you so much for joining me today. And ladies and gentlemen, we will see you next time for another Mama Bear Apologetics podcast. If you've enjoyed this podcast, hop over to mamabearapologetics.com, where you can get more links to podcasts, blogs, and even request a speaker for your next women's event, family retreat, or your next church conference.
Mama Bear Apologetics is a listener-supported program, so if you really like what we're doing, please go over to our website, www.mamabearapologetics.com, and click donate.